Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. A new record again today for oil prices, $109 a barrel. AAA says we could be pumping $4 gas by summer. Today, we'll look at how that hits the way we move, ourselves, our freight, our economy. Signs of change are here. Consumers driving less, truckers idling their rigs, airlines piling on fuel surcharges, trains getting a second look. It's a wild ride. This hour, On Point, soaring oil and our transport future. Later in this hour, we'll look at the prostitution scandal engulfing New York Governor Eliot Spitzer. But first today, oil itself and that price that just keeps rising. Javier Blas covers oil markets for the Financial Times. He joins us from London. Javier Blas, thanks for being here. What are we here today? 109 in Europe?
Yeah, we have, hello Tom, we have 109.72, so very close to 110 for crude oil following a neutral to bullish report from the International Energy Agency, the watchdog from rich countries that said that demand is keeping up even as we are trading the oil prices above $100.
So nearly $110 now, and this is not just highest in current dollar terms, but highest record high in all times, inflation-adjusted terms.
It is highest ever. You could look at that different ways, but it's the highest price we have ever paid. It is the highest in nominal terms, and if we even take in account how much inflation we have accumulated in the last 20 to 30 years is also highest than the price we pay in 79 in the second oil crisis or the price we pay in the 73, 74 during the first oil crisis. You can look at different ways, but what traders, analysts, and economists are telling me is that it is the highest price we have ever paid.
Now, Javier, help us understand why this is happening. We're hearing different explanations. One, simply that the dollar is becoming weaker, so it takes more dollars to buy that oil. At the same time, you're telling us right now that the demand is seen as keeping up, still strong. So is it demand? Is it the weak dollar? Is it a scarcity of oil? What's driving the high price?
That's a very good question, Tom. I think that you cannot pinpoint just to one only factor, but it's a combination of several factors. I will say that for the last few years, fundamental factors has been the most on explaining why prices are so high. Demand is rising very fast, in particular in emerging countries, but think about China, India, Brazil, and also the Middle East, countries where the population is affording for the first time to buy cars, to buy heating for their homes, to buy air conditioner for the summer, and to buy a general trend of new ways to consume more energy. That's a new factor. A second factor, fundamental factor, is that oil companies, particularly Western ones, think about Exxon, Chevron, BP or Shell, are finding less oil than in the past. And also the cost of extracting that oil is rising fastly. It's not longer that they are extracting oil in a very easy place in Texas. It's that they have to go to places very difficult, like Sakhalin in Russia, mm-hmm. or the deep waters in the Gulf. And on top of that, you have new factors that are helping now, like the weakness of the dollar and some financial speculation in the market that is also keeping prices up. But it's a combination of different factors.
And yet, for all of that, there must be some limit here. What's the wise guy talk? What are traders saying, Javier? How high can oil go in the, I don't know, in the, let's say in 08?
I will not venture, because if you asked me 2 years ago, it was $50. A year ago, the war among traders and specialists was that $75 was the top. They say, no way we can go above 75. Today, we are 110, so the new figure is probably 125. And it keeps rising every year. I mean, the key point is that at some price, the demand will collapse and then prices will fall. A problem. Those places where oil is rising in consumption, they are not paying $110, or they are not paying the gasoline at $3 a gallon like in the States. It's China, where the government is subsidizing the gasoline. Hmm. They pay a price that for a Chinese citizen, oil prices are still at $40. That's a big problem. oil is cheaper in Saudi Arabia than water, the same in Venezuela or in Nigeria. And in those countries, demand is skyrocketing. So we will not, until those countries begin to pay the real price of oil, where we will see a reaction.
Demand all over, prices way up, and maybe more to come. Javier Blas with the Financial Times in London, thanks very much for bringing us up to date on the latest. A new historic high today, nearly $109.72 in Europe. Javier, thanks for being here.
My pleasure.
We're looking today at high oil and how we move, America's transportation problem. Joining me now from Ithaca, New York, is Rick Geddes. He's an economist and professor at Cornell University. He served as economist for the National Surface Transportation Policy Commission, which just issued a big report to Congress in January of this year. In 2004 and 2005, he served as a senior economist on the White House Council of Economic Advisors under President Bush. Rick Geddes, Professor Geddes, thanks very much for being here.
Hello, Tom. Thanks for inviting me.
You've got a big view of transportation. Many of our listeners will have a very immediate view of the gas pump and what it costs to fill the car and the household budget. But at $100 a barrel, $110 nearly dollars a barrel, how do you describe it overall? Are we in a crunch, a crisis, a moment of challenge when it comes to moving ourselves and our goods around this country?
Well, I think we are at a moment of profound change with regard to the transportation system. People are obviously going to respond to these high prices by cutting back on the amount of driving that they do. The cost of transported goods, everything that's moved by truck, which is almost everything that we consume, I think, is going to go up. And I think people are going to adjust to that in a whole variety of ways. My sense is of this this current run-up in the price is that people don't perceive it as being merely a spike up. They perceive it as being sort of a long-term change, and I think that it's going to cause profound changes in our transportation system as well.
Well, does that mean Americans should look forward to something fundamentally different in the way things and people move around? Or will it be, we'll still be primarily a car-based country, we'll still have all the big rigs on the road, will still fly to grandma's house for, you know, the holidays. It'll just bite a little deeper into people's pockets? Or is it something more than that?
Well, my sense is that it is something more than that. A big issue here is that I learned while I was serving on the Transportation Policy Commission was the way our transportation system is funded is mainly through gas and diesel taxes. Mm. And those are both at the state and the federal level. And those taxes are in the federal level, they go to the federal government into a fund that funds both the highways and the transit system. And then the federal government redistributes that money back to the states for transportation purposes, maintaining roads, building new roads, et cetera. And as people react to these high gas prices and begin to drive less, we're going to see revenues flowing into that fund decline. And that decline is going to occur at precisely the time, a time when our transportation infrastructure needs a lot more investment. So that those funds are going to have to come from some other source, I think, besides the gas taxes that we have traditionally used as a nation to fund our infrastructure, which is, of course, becoming more important for commerce and personal movement.
Now, that's kind of a bewildering prospect. You're saying we need a fundamental change, but the money to do it won't be there as people back off of those the high-priced gasoline and diesel. Does that mean we're sort of locked in to our current? And we have what we have. We have roads, we have the runways, and rails kind of that we have, though train rail is expanding. But do we really have the flexibility as a nation to change fundamentally the way we move?
Well, I'm an optimist here, Tom. I believe that one of the strengths of the United States is that we are a very flexible nation and that we are people who can adjust to a profound change like this. And I believe that we are on the verge of a major paradigm shift in the way that we fund and the way that surface transportation operates. I believe that we're going to have to move away from this old gas tax model, which really came out of this 1956 bill that President Eisenhower championed, the Federal Aid Highway Act, that built the interstate system. And it was very successful, and we have a tremendous infrastructure in our nation's interstate system, but we're going to have to come up with a different way of funding that. And I believe we're going to move away from reliance on gas taxes and move toward reliance on more tolling and pricing of our nation's roads, which is what a lot of other countries have done.
Does that mean moving away from automobiles and trucks toward trains and buses, or it's just paying more in a different way for essentially the same ratio of automobile and big rig traffic?
Well, I don't believe that that cars or heavy trucks are going to go away at any time in the future. I believe that people will adjust. I think that they will adjust by driving less. They'll probably take more public transit. They will, in the short run, carpool more. They could combine shopping trips with commuting to work. In the long term, of course, people can buy more fuel-efficient vehicles, and we are seeing the demand for more fuel-efficient vehicles rise rapidly. And I think once electric vehicles become more widely available, you'll see that as well. I think in the long term, people will see changes in land use. We'll see people move closer to their work. We might even see employers adjust so that they move closer to where their employee base is. So I believe that there's a whole range of ways that we will adjust to this sort of high and permanent level of fossil fuels. But I don't believe that means we're going to see trains, trucks or cars go off the road at any time.
But Americans
soon.
Changing the way they move one way or another. Rick Geddes, please stand by at Cornell. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about record high oil prices and how we move ourselves, our freight, our world. Talking about planes, trains, automobiles, transportation in a world of high oil, and how we're going to get around with oil now at $109 today a barrel, and maybe headed higher. We've been joined from Ithaca, New York, by Rick Geddes, professor and economist at Cornell University. Been in the middle of a lot of big thinking about transportation recently, in the middle of a big report submitted to Congress in January of this year. And we're joined as well now from Albany, New York, by James Howard Kunstler, leading critical voice on America's energy and sprawl problems. His new novel is World Made by Hand, which imagines a future where our energy economy has collapsed in the face of oil shortages and climate change. His best-selling nonfiction book, The Long Emergency, out in 2005, made the case that a looming energy crisis will force radical shifts in American life. James Kunstler, thanks very much for being here.
Nice to be here, Tom.
So Rick Geddes says we're going to have to change the way we pay for things. We may see more toll roads and tolling and heavy use charges for getting around, but we're essentially still going to get around by cars and trucks because that's what we've got. What do you say?
I wouldn't agree with that. I think that the reality is going to be inconsistent with those kinds of expectations. We have an enormous problem. We have a suburban living arrangement that has no future, an infrastructure for daily living that has no future. And I view it as the greatest misallocation of resources in the history of the world. It has we've taken all of our national wealth in the post-World War II era and put it into this project, and now we are stuck with it. But it has provoked something even more of a problem, a psychology of previous investment, which is a huge obstacle to us thinking coherently about what we're going to do with this.
So you're saying what? When you say the infrastructure, you're talking about the interstate highways and the way we move today as an inappropriate infrastructure for the energy future that's now right in front of us?
Yes, I would say that a lot of our wishes about running all of this stuff on something other than oil amount to a dangerous fantasy. We are not going to run the interstate highway system, Walmart, and Walt Disney World on any combination of solar, wind, nuclear, used French fried potato oil, ethanol, or any other rescue remedy that is now being touted. And we're going to be very disappointed about what these alternate fuels can do for us. We really have to make comprehensive new arrangements for living in this country where we are completely unprepared for it. We're sleepwalking into the future, and it's going to be a very disorderly process.
And yet you say yourself, we're kind of stuck with what we've got. We've made a gigantic multi-trillion-dollar investment in the infrastructure we've got.
That's right. And it's an enormous problem. But there are things we can do. I would not bank on keeping the truck and automobile system running as it has been running. I think the number one thing we have to do in this country is repair the passenger railroad system. We have a railroad system that the Bulgarians would be ashamed of. And there's no other project we could do right away that would have a greater impact on our oil use. It is desperately important that we do this. And the fact that our leaders in business and politics and everywhere else are not talking about this shows how unserious we are.
Rick Geddes, there's a bracing view of the future, and for all I know, you may share much of it. And yet, at the same time, even James Kunstler says we're stuck with a lot of what we've got right now. So is this workable in economic terms, what we're looking out on in terms of a transportation infrastructure? And if we've got to make some kind of radical change, how do you begin to get there? We've seen for years the vested interests in this country that sort of like things just the way they are.
Well, I must say that Mr. Kunstler's views are very provocative here. And being an economist, I was very pleased to hear him discuss the misallocation of resources that occurs under the current system. And I agree with that. I think that there are serious misallocations that occur. Part of it occurs because of the irrational pricing that we have, or tolling, if you want to use that term, of the current system. And that has, I think, contributed, I'm certain that that has contributed to the massive decline in the performance of our transportation system. And when I say performance, just to be clear, I mean the purpose of our transportation system is to move people from point A to point B. We value mobility. We value mobility of passengers, and we value mobility of freight. So we want to move things from point A to point B as expeditiously as possible. But as everybody knows who drives in any urban center of even modest size, the levels of congestion on our nation's roads have increased tremendously in previous years or in recent years, and that has caused the performance of the system to decline precipitously. And I think that needs to be addressed, and that's obviously cutting into our mobility. And we know how to address that. We move to a pricing or tolling system, but the prices or tolls need to vary with the level of demand on a particular road at a particular time. So if you want to use a road during peak times, the price of using that road needs to be higher.
So you're saying that the fundamental infrastructure won't change, but the way we use it will change? Our interaction with this big infrastructure of highways will change? Will have to change?
That's exactly it, Tom. That's very well put. That's exactly our interaction with the infrastructure that we have will change. I don't think it's realistic that we'll tear up the interstate or that there will be some cataclysmic shift. But I think that the way that is allocated, so Mr. Kunstler mentioned the misallocation of those resources. The way those resources are allocated will change, because I believe that we will and we have to move to a system where it's more rationally priced. The old fuel tax system that we've used just can't get us there. And this is not some economic theory that I'm making up right now. This is used currently in a highway that goes in and out of Minneapolis, for example, that is priced in real time. And that road is priced to keep the traffic at free flow constantly. So that means you get the maximum use of the road that you have. And that solves a number of problems. It helps address congestion and helps address environmental pollution as well. But so Jim, there's a whole lot of benefits.
Jim Kunstler, is this the way out of the – I mean, you describe a situation on the one hand where sort of we need to change, but we can't change, but we must change, feels trapped. Will setting new tolls and charges all over the place to reflect the real cost of travel do it? Will that get us to a transportation future that syncs up with the energy situation we're facing?
No, I would state categorically it won't. It's not going to be a matter of just jiggering the tolls or jiggering the pricing. There are too many elements in flux right now, and probably we have to check all of our assumptions at the door, about especially our status quo assumptions about what's going on. Not the least of the elements ongoing right now as we speak is a very serious financial meltdown in the United States, which is going to affect a lot of things. We are probably also talking about entering a time when the price of oil itself is not going to be the issue so much as spot scarcities and regional scarcities of oil. And once that occurs, all bets are off about what are the attitudes of the public will be. You know, when I say we're stuck with the infrastructure of motoring and highways, you know, I recognize that it's there. I'm certainly not suggesting that we take it down. In fact, we're going to be not affluent enough to even think about doing that. But we're going to have to make very, very different arrangements for how we do things. And I think what it ultimately means is that we better not expect to be living in quite the same kind of culture as we are now. We're going to be living far more locally. A lot of the complex systems we depend on right now, like national big box chain shopping, which depends on 12,000-mile supply lines to Asia, and just-in-time inventory, and the warehouse on wheels, which is, in effect, the incessant circulation of tractor trailers on the interstate.
Right.
All of these things are not going to be happening anymore. We're probably not even going to be able to keep the interstate highways in good enough repair for trucks to run on them, even if we had the fuel to do it.
Boy, I'm having my mind blown pretty quickly here. I don't know what kind of time frame we're talking about. Let's let our listeners into the conversation. Mike in Waterbury, Connecticut. Mike, you're on the air.
Hey, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
Your guest, the author of The Long Emergency, took a lot of the words out of my mouth. I was going to mention his book, as well as Beyond Oil and books about peak oil, which people have been talking about for decades, and nobody's been listening. And now that we're actually there in the beginning of this emergency, suddenly now it's important.
Well, it hurts when you pay $50 or $60 or $70 to fill up, or $500 or $1,000 if you're driving a big rig.
Right, absolutely. I mean, I say let the price of oil keep going up to $200 a barrel. And as unpopular as it might be to say that, maybe high prices like that will encourage industry and governments to actually make changes, because when oil is cheap and it allows you to, you know, live your life, you know, a couple dollars extra to fill your tank doesn't really make that much of an impact.
But, Mike, how are people going to live that way? How are they going to get to work? How are they going to balance the family budget if they're paying, you know, many multiples of what they're paying now just to get around to do what we understand is necessary?
Well, again, your guest makes the point that things aren't going to stay the same. People are going to have to find other ways to get to work, ride their bike, take the bus. If more more of people can't afford to fill their tanks, there will be more demand for public transportation. Governments hopefully will take the hint and improve public transportation. I mean, not to get political, but for the price of this war that we're fighting, we could have built a nationwide electric rail system, which would eliminate a lot of the problems we're predicting for automobile transport.
Mike, let's look at what's possible here. Rick Geddes, how much capacity do we have to shift the way we move to public transportation or otherwise? I mean, James Kunstler is saying, look, you're not going to be affluent enough to rebuild everything. You're talking about tolling, but is that just to sort of make the best of perhaps a bit of a misfit transportation system, or are we going to move people closer to where they worked? Are we going to have wholesale uprooting of the suburban picture we all look out on now?
Well, I don't see it as quite so drastic. I think that the changes will occur over time. I think that, as I said before, people will relocate. I think there will be changes in land use patterns. I think Mr. Kunstler is right about his point about things becoming more local. When we served on the commission, we toured some developments that are focused on having people live where they work and having shopping near where they live. Atlantic Station in Atlanta, I recall, was one, which is a community that's planned to keep the amount of commuting that people do down. I think we could see more of those developments, and that obviously would be a rational adjustment to higher gas prices. I think that in terms of public transportation, you can think of different ways of doing it. You could make bus systems, I think, much better and much more efficient. I think that there are some issues regarding rail. When you use passenger rail, I think Mr. Kunstler mentioned passenger rail. I think that's an important element of the story. But that there are problems with passenger rail in this country. For example, Amtrak has to run on a lot of freight rail tracks, and that moves freight trains, which we think are also efficient, off of the tracks that they own. So to let the passenger rail go through, and we've lost a lot of that right of way in this country for passenger and freight rail. Over time, actually, the miles of right-of-way that we have for rail has declined.
But a lot going on there right now.
It's only now increasing.
Yeah, the biggest investments in rail in a century, we read, going on right now as people look out on this picture. Let's take a call from Cambridge, Massachusetts, and Yale. Yale, you're on the air.
Oh, hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Yes.
Great many of the things your earlier callers have said are very interesting, not to repeat, but clearly the physical pattern of residence that has been created by the dependence on the automobile is so permanent and in place that it's difficult to contemplate that with any reasonable length of time a change could be made that would adapt itself to some reasonable system of mass transportation.
I couldn't agree more. It's hard to picture it. What are the implications of that, then? What does that mean?
Country in the Western world, at least, that purposefully dismantled an existing rail mass transit system to create a pattern of living totally dependent on the automobile.
But here we are. We've got it. And now gas is $3 plus a gallon. What happens?
In the very short run, it would seem that the only possibility is to devise some way of moving that automobile that doesn't depend on oil. There may be the ingenuity to do that. I don't know. But clearly, I think, and particularly someone earlier mentioned, well, people are going to move. We are in the midst of a growing recession in which lending for housing is the most seriously pinched element of the financial system.
And right. Credit all bound up. Moving is not easy, and we know people do it slowly. Thank you very much for your call. Jim Kunstler, how about it? Here we've got a smart listener who says you're not going to move all that housing stock.
Well,
you've got to figure a different way to fuel those automobiles to get Americans around.
Your listener has just described the psychology of previous investment precisely. And, you know, when I go around the country to colleges and you know, other cities, what I notice is that the only conversation that we're having is how are we going to keep the cars running by other means than oil. And it's simply not enough of a conversation. We've got to talk about other things. Now, Mr. Geddes said that we have a problem running passenger trains because, you know, we don't have an extra track. Well, you know, the implication or the assumption there is that we're willing to spend even more trillions of dollars propping up the car system, and yet we're not willing to spend a fraction of that improving our rail system. It's crazy. You know, we have in the New York Central Railroad, which runs from, you know, Albany to Buffalo, there is a second track, but the CSX company ripped it up because we have a silly, punitive real estate tax.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about record high oil prices and how we move ourselves, our freight, our world transportation in a world of high oil. A little later in this hour, we'll look at Eliot Spitzer's prostitution problem, what's going on with the governor of New York, and a career that may be going down in flames right now. But right now, you can join the conversation on transportation. What do you think? Can we keep our big rigs on the road at these fuel prices? What's the alternative? And will America keep on trucking or start to shut down to change, maybe radically, under High Oil. We've been joined by James Howard Kunstler. He's author of The Long Emergency and World Made by Hand. Big critic, critical voice on America's energy and sprawl problems. Rick Geddes is with us, professor and economist at Cornell University. Mark is calling from Providence, Rhode Island. Hi, Mark. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. How are you doing?
Well.
We've talked a lot about rail and automotive traffic and truck traffic, and it's easy to sort of imagine, assuming we keep them going, a post-petroleum motor force. What about air traffic, which I would see as going away as soon as we lose petroleum, except for the Air Force?
Goodbye to passenger jets. That sounds pretty radical. That's what
right, I could see petroleum being a national security resource.
Yeah, it's a big question, and I wonder as well, Mark. Thanks for that, Rick Geddes. Let's look up at the air for a second. Our caller Mark wonders if we're going to see anything but Air Force up there if oil keeps going up. What are the economics of air travel if oil goes? It's 110 now. If I don't know if it goes to 150. Can we keep flying? There are fuel surcharges, but still lots of people flying all over the place.
Well, I think you're going to see a response in the prices. The price of an air ticket is obviously going to reflect the jet fuel that the company has to use when it flies that flight. So that'll be reflected in prices, and consumers can adjust to those prices as they see fit. That's what they do, and they might choose to fly less. They might choose to fly shorter distances on vacation. They might choose to stay closer to home on vacations. We can imagine a number of ways that people would adjust, but I would never see I do not foresee a situation where air travel for commercial flights would be eliminated altogether. I believe it may become more expensive and probably will, but I see people adjusting to that in a variety of ways. You could also imagine that the type of aircraft would adjust to it to become better suited to the number of people traveling on a particular route. So I see a lot of ways people could adjust to that.
And you say airfares will reflect oil price over time, but do you see more or less the same volume of air traffic going forward, or is it something that gets restricted to the very affluent at some point?
No, I don't see that happening. I think that the demands on our – one thing that we did discover on the Transportation Commission is that given the demographics of our nation, the growth in population expected, it's likely that the demands on our transportation system are going to increase in the future.
Mm-hmm.
And I believe that is all aspects of the transportation system, including the roads, the ports, the intermodal facilities, the freight rail, as well as the airports and air transportation. So even if prices are high, I'm not sure that it's just too important. Mobility is just simply too important for people in this country. And I don't see that sort of coming to an end in the near future. So I think even though prices are high, the value created by being able to fly from point A to point B quickly is high enough that people are willing to pay that.
Jim Kunstler, how do you see the future of air traffic, of passenger air travel?
Well, I don't think that we're going to be having a passenger airline service of the type we've been used to very far into the future. I think that, it's really not about what we want. I think this is a major mistake that people are making in their thinking. It's not about what we want. It's about what the future will require us to do or compel us to do. And I think that airline travel will first become an elite activity as it began, 80 years ago, and then it will not exist at all, and we'll have to make other arrangements for getting around.
At what price per barrel of oil do you see that kind of – I mean, that's mind-blowing. Everybody's got second homes that they fly to.
Factor.
They live all over the country because they can know they can fly to see their family. Are we talking about $110, $150 a barrel? When does that flip out of possibility?
It's not just about that one factor. You know, we make the mistake of thinking it's just one factor. It will be a combination of high prices for aviation fuel and the airlines losing their customers because the economy is tanking and people are severely losing their incomes and are not going to be making those trips to visit grandma in Louisville. So and there are probably other factors too, but the business equation of the airlines as they are currently organized is not going to be supported by the circumstances of the future.
Boy, you're describing a lot of unhappy people who can't get together for the family.
It's not about whether we're happy or not.
Right.
It's about what the future is going to require us to do.
Wow.
You know, we've got to get clear about that.
No, we hear it loud and clear. Let's go to Preston calling from Boston. Hi, Preston. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
The romance of the rails was a good comment because I started taking the rail on the border of New Hampshire in Haverhill, Massachusetts, mm-hmm. and I started taking rail lately on the commuter rail pass, and I'm saving about $500 or $600 a month. It requires me to get up a little bit earlier, but it avoids a lot of headache. And there's a huge ridership that's available just over the border because I work at Harvard Medical School, and there's a lot of folks from southern New Hampshire that the rail does not go up to that are just dying to get the rail up there.
And you're saving $500 or $600 a month. That's a pretty good change in the pocket.
Absolutely, and that's just because of the fuel prices that have gone up. And when I 4 years ago, when my job had me up in Maine, it took 10 years, a decade, to get the rail up in Maine. And the ridership, when it finally came to, exceeded expectations the first year by 68%, and that's on the Downeaster.
Do you miss the freedom of having your car, though, Preston?
You do, but you get to read, you get to sleep, you get to listen to WBUR on your MP3 player. You get all kinds of options on the train.
Right on. Thanks very much for calling. Let's go to Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, and Chris. Chris, you're on the air.
Hi. I wanted to say that there's a very simple investment that can help urban congestion and carbon emissions in an urban setting, and that's bike infrastructure. I just moved down to Pittsburgh from Cambridge, where there's bike lanes on every street, and down here they're starting to, you know, put some paint down on the roads, but it's definitely a step behind, and it makes it a challenge to get around within the city. But biking has so many inherent advantages over using a car for short trips in an urban setting.
But how many millions of Americans are you going to see with their, you know, keisters on a bike seat?
Well, you go to Europe and, you know, they're all over the place. Something like, you know, 40% of trips taken in Amsterdam within the city are on a bicycle. And here in Pittsburgh, it's, you know, down under 1%.
So. Wow. We're going to be a very fit nation, perhaps, once again. Chris in Pittsburgh, thanks for that. And one more from Alan in Cambridge, Massachusetts. Alan, you're on the air.
Yes. How are you doing? Great book, by the way, The Long Emergency. I read it and I take it as a real estate agent.
Mm.
And my feeling is we have to have a national emergency here, immediately try and switch everything to electric cars and serious look at wind power, alternative energy, even nuclear, just to get us off this foreign oil. And your prediction, if this happened in 2012, I think, has come to roost here in 2008. And I think oil's be $250 a barrel in 18 months.
Jim Kunstler predicting it later on. Did you say you're in real estate, Alan?
Yeah, and this is going to really destroy the suburban market. I mean, inner cities, we're doing okay here in Cambridge in the market, but everything's just sitting in the outer suburban belts, and this is going to be the new ghettos.
Wow. I was just thinking about what it costs to put gas in the tank. I'm having all kinds of mental infrastructure blown away here. Jim Kunstler, what about a time frame for the kind of, I mean, maybe Rick Geddes is right that we'll adapt to this, we'll toll, we'll do this and we'll that, and we'll muddle through. You're talking about radical change. In what time frame?
I think we're going to be in real trouble within 5 years.
That's like day after tomorrow.
Yeah, it is. You know, we're probably going to be in, we're going to be facing scarcities probably sooner than that. The poster child for this, by the way, is Mexico. You know, we get, Mexico is our third largest source of imports, and they are depleting at a stupendous rate of a minimum of about 15% a year. They're using a lot more of their own oil, and they're not going to be able to send us any oil within, you know, the next 5 years or so. And this process is going on all over the world now, and it's taking the form of what's being called the export crisis. It's sort of a new wrinkle in the story. It's not really on the radar screen of our business and political leaders, but it's going to have a huge effect on us very quickly.
Big change coming. Rick Geddes, how about it? Do I have to sell the car, move to the city center, get a bike, and forget about, you know, my brother in Dallas?
Tom, I wouldn't do that just now. I don't buy into the Planet of the Apes scenario that some are suggesting here as a result of high oil prices. I think that the economy that we have is highly flexible, and I think it needs to be c- kept flexible so that we can respond to this in a whole variety of ways, and we avoid silly policy responses to this that make things worse. So we need to keep regulation down so that the economy can be responsive to it.
Well, there's the challenge right in front of us. We'll see how it plays out and check in with the two of you for your comment on where we go. Rick Geddes, wonderful having you with us today at Cornell University. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you, Tom.
And James Howard Kunstler, author of World Made by Hand and The Long Emergency. Mr. Kunstler, thanks for joining us today.
Nice to be here with you.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Yesterday, New York Governor Eliot Spitzer, who swept into office as a crime-busting crusader, was implicated as a client of a high-end prostitution ring. After the New York Times broke the story, Spitzer made a terse statement to the press.
I have acted in a way that violates my obligations to my family and that violates my or any sense of right and wrong.
Joining me from Albany, New York, to talk about the fallout is Ellis Hennigan, columnist at Newsday and commentator for Fox News. Ellis Hennigan, thanks very much for being with us. What do we know? What happened here?
Well, just don't call me client number 10.
Okay, yes, client 9, Spitzer, yes.
No, there is Governor, thinking that he may resign by the end of the day, don't know that for sure, but he has been now caught in this call girl scandal where his voice shows up on federal wiretaps, having arranged for a high-priced call girl to meet him at the Mayflower Hotel in Washington.
And this is just last month on the eve of Valentine's Day.
You know, it's a romantic time. Men's minds turn to all kinds of things, I suppose.
Speechless almost, but Eliot Spitzer was supposed to be this kind of bulwark of rectitude in public and private life, on Wall Street and everywhere else. Are New Yorkers shocked?
Well, yeah, a little bit. I have to tell you, if I had given you a list, Tom, of 30 things that would trip up Eliot Spitzer, this would not have been in the top 30. Here's the best way to think of him. He's kind of like the Democratic Rudy Giuliani. He's very smart. He's very intense. He's very ambitious. But he has a kind of prosecutorial, self-righteous streak that turns out to be, I think, his fatal flaw. Boy, he's falling on it right now.
Well, he went after a lot of people, some now, I suppose, cackling with glee. But are we, as a country, a little overwrought about this? I mean, he fell off the straight and narrow in his marriage, first of all, here, in a big way. But we don't know that it was a habit. I mean, we just don't know. Is it clear that this is going to cost him his political life or not?
You know, they'd have to impeach him and convict him to get rid of him if he doesn't want to go. But there's some backdrop here that's worth understanding. He arrived in office 14, 15 months ago on a huge popular vote with a growing support in the legislature and proceeded in the next 6 or 9 months to blow it. He alienated the legislators, even describing himself once as a steamroller. He got himself in some trouble spying on the Republican boss in the Senate. And so he has alienated even many of his friends here. I think it's pretty likely that he will make the judgment that even if he could hang on by his fingernails, it may be a case of why bother. Plus, there's some criminal liability potentially out here.
What's the criminal liability?
Well, you know, these federal cases do not normally go after the Johns, right, when they do these prostitution busts. But there's some elements of it. There's some moving money around in some funny ways. There's something called the Mann Act that prohibits taking someone across state lines for illicit sexual purposes.
And in this case, he arranged or invited or whatever for the, allegedly, for the prostitute to come down from New York to Washington. Seems like a long way. Is Washington that shy on prostitutes?
You know, I'd always heard they had people like that down there. But no, he made arrangements with an agency that apparently he had had some previous relationship with. And this young lady, Kristen, at the tune of $4,300, agreed to come down to Washington and meet him in the Mayflower Hotel room 817, if you want to book it at some point.
Do you think that citizens of New York would insist on impeachment if Spitzer himself decides to stay in? Does this sound look like an offense that would just be too much for the public sensibility of the state of New York?
Well, Tom, I don't know that the public sensibility of the state of New York is quite all that delicate. I mean, the guy's accused of, you know, going to a prostitute, and while, you know, lots of people find that distasteful, and it is technically illegal. I don't know that it's the highest crime we could imagine. It's going to play out, though, in the end on the political power, on the relationships, and I think what his level of support is. And it's been declining for a bunch of other reasons that I just mentioned.
And what about on the vengeance front? Wall Street, some big Wall Street people were pretty upset with Elliot Spitzer for the way he brought them down. Is there you know, a sense of just desserts here, or people who he brought low, you know, chuckling now at his woe?
Well, I'll tell you two things. First, a lot of single malt scotch poured at Delmonico's last night.
Mm.
And secondly, when the news first came across the wire, there were cheers on the floor of the American Stock, excuse me, the New York Stock Exchange.
Wow.
And so, you know, listen, anytime anyone presents themselves in a self-righteous, moralistic way, and then is caught doing just the very thing they were railing against, I mean, it's hard not to have, what, a little bit of ironic glee in there somewhere.
Well, except I don't know if he was crusading against prostitution, and, you know, he certainly went after Wall Street in a time when we now know Wall Street had a lot of stuff going on that it shouldn't have. A loss if Elliot Spitzer goes at the same time.
Huh? Yeah, some days it's hard to tell those two professions apart, I think.
Oh, ouch. Ellis Hennekin at Newsday, thanks very much for being with us.
Good to be with you, Tom.
Well, there's Elliot Spitzer, and wow, what a pitiful scene with next to his wife the yesterday in the news conference. Our sympathy to everybody who gets hurt in that one. Listeners, you can continue the conversation and download the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.